It is Wednesday, August 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump creates frustration among his party's members.
Donald Trump has recently said that he's not able to support the House Speaker, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan, in his primary, in his Republican primary.
The Syrian government and opposition accuse the other of using chemical weapons, and the Chinese Typewriter Museum prepares to travel the world. It's all ahead. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is continuing his feud with the parents of a fallen U.S. soldier who was killed in Iraq in 2004. This started during last week's Democratic National Convention when Khazir Khan gave a speech before the convention very critical of Mr. Trump. I'm joined now by VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain. Cindy, this seems to be a story that just keeps continuing.
Yes, that's right, Sarah, it does. And it seems to really be causing some chaos within the greater Republican Party. And you have, for the first time, some elected Republican officials who are now coming out and saying that they are going to vote for Hillary Clinton, including one New York congressman who is retiring, I should say, but Richard Hanna, who has said that Trump is unfit and that he's, you know, nervous about what he would do and that he's a national embarrassment and that he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
And this follows there are other prominent Republicans such as Mitt Romney, who was the party's nominee for president in 2012. He said there's no way he's voting for Trump. And another, you know, certainly a number of prominent Republicans, members of Congress, did not attend the most recent Republican National Convention. So there seems to be a certain amount of, I guess you could say, chaos in the GOP a bit.
Yes, that's right. And with all this happening with this controversy of the parents of the slain soldier who died fighting for his country in Iraq, and then on top of that, Donald Trump has recently said that he's not able to support the House Speaker, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan, in his primary, in his Republican primary. So this has really angered Republicans who feel like, you know, they've had a difficult time defending some of Mr. Trump's more controversial remarks, and now Trump is saying that he cannot endorse Speaker Paul Ryan and Senator John McCain, who's also in a tough re-election bid. So this is the moment, I think, is a difficult time for Republicans.
Because that would affect their standing within Congress.
Yes, that's exactly right. And to do it at a time where one would think that, you know, he himself is under fire just seems counterintuitive. But, of course, a lot of things about this presidential race have been different this time.
Yesterday, President Barack Obama was very critical of Donald Trump. You know, he said he was unfit for office. But he also singled out Trump for being critical of a Gold Star family. Those are families that have lost someone in their family who's been killed in the line of duty. And, you know, again, the Republican Party has always seemed very close. I mean, both parties are close to the American military, but it seems the Republican Party always particularly has been.
Right. And I think that this is something that which has been almost sacred. You know, families who have the Gold Star families who have really had the ultimate sacrifice to lose a family member. And it's just unheard of. And I think it's very unusual for President Obama to say that he's condemned some of the things that Trump has said, especially the ban on Muslim and, you know, remarks about Mexicans and things like that. But to say that he is, I have not heard the word unfit. And that was, and I spoke with presidential historian Alan Lichtman, and he said he cannot recall in modern American history that a sitting president has said that an opposition candidate is unfit to serve. He said, of course, you know, presidents have criticized members of the opposing party, but not to go as far to say that he is, as President Obama said, is woefully unprepared.
All right, White House correspondent Cindy Sain, thanks very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Sarah.
Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, you have a geopolitical story that has become an American political story, and it has to deal with Iran, payments that the U.S. made $400 million to Iran, roughly around the same time that a number of U.S. Hostages were released from Iran and freed. Now, a lot of people on the right are saying this is curious timing. It seems like the U.S. paid Iran for these hostages. And so, fascinatingly, we're seeing people who were against Donald Trump kind of combining with him and the right, kind of coalescing on social media, at least around this idea that the Obama administration may have done something illegal. So you see names like Marco Rubio, John McCain, Speaker Ryan, all tweeting out about this, as well as Donald Trump saying, you know, our incompetent Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was the one who started the talks for the $400 million. Well, it turns out the White House has rebuffed those claims, saying that that's not correct. And some journalists have said that Donald Trump's not correct in making that statement, that the talks actually began under John Kerry. But this is just another case where something that has global implications or a global news story is kind of imbued with the filter of U.S. politics. Everything seems to be focused on U.S. politics in one way or another as our election approaches. But this is playing out, we see now, on social media. And as we have talked about over the past few weeks, some very sad stories, a very positive one that we'll talk about today, and that's this plane crash in Dubai. Now, that plane crash normally wouldn't be a positive story, but
right.
This plane, an Emirates Airlines flight from India, landed apparently without its landing gear, or there was a landing gear failure. The plane actually caught on fire. All 300 passengers and crew on board survived that crash, and it doesn't appear there were any serious injuries. But social media sharing those images and the video, really stunning video, and even more so when you consider that everyone made it safe.
They were very, very fortunate.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. South Africa's ruling party faces a stiff challenge. North Korea launches a missile into the ocean. Russia denies involvement in Syrian gas attacks. And a plane catches fire after crash landing at Dubai International Airport. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study finds a huge region at the center of the Milky Way is devoid of young stars. A team of Japanese, South African, and Italian astronomers found that there are no Cepheid stars in an area that extends some 8,000 light years from our galaxy center. Cepheid stars are said to repeatedly pulsate in brightness and are quite young, between 10 and 300 million years old, in comparison to our 4.6 billion-year-old sun. Giuseppe Bono, one of the study's authors, said their research shows that there has been no significant star formation in this large patch of the Milky Way for over hundreds of millions of years. The researchers made their findings after analyzing observations made in the near-infrared light range, since looking for stars so deep in the galaxy can be quite difficult. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we speak with the curator of the Chinese Typewriter Museum. Both the government in Syria and the opposition are trading charges of using chemical weapons after reports surfaced Tuesday of civilians being treated following a toxic gas attack in rebel-held Idlib province. It is close to the site where a Russian helicopter was downed Monday, killing five Russian personnel. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Washington is looking into the reports.
If it's true, and again, I'm not saying it is, but if it's true, it would be extremely serious. We've long expressed our strong condemnation of the use of chemical weapons on civilians, which of course violates not only the cessation of hostilities, but international standards and norms, including the Chemical Weapons Convention, to which the government of Syria is a member, as well as two UN Security Council resolutions, 2118 and 2209. So again, not in a position to confirm. We're taking it seriously. We're looking into it, and we'll see. Now, as you also I think, know from prior reports of the potential use of and I know you're not saying this was chlorine, neither am I, but you know the alleged use of chlorine, that the OPCW has the monitoring the responsibility for that, and those investigations can take quite some time to try to actually determine what happened. But obviously it's a serious report, and we're certainly concerned about it.
In 2013, UN investigators determined that sarin gas had been used in eastern Ghouta province, killing nearly 1,500 people. The U.S. implicated Syria's government in that attack. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in Texas tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, assigning blame is hard without independent verification of the various charges.
A top-level diplomat told me a few years back regarding the Syrian civil war is that there are two wars going on in Syria. There's the one real one with the people firing at each other and explosions and bombs and all that sort of stuff. And then there's the misinformation war. And the information coming out of Syria I've learned to be quite skeptical of coming from either side. I take everything with a grain of salt, particularly because we really have very little, if any, on-the-ground reporting, and most of the information comes from organizations that clearly are anti-Assad. Now, having said that, are there still chemical weapons still being used? That wouldn't surprise me at all, either by the government or even by various opposition groups.
UN investigators 3 years ago said sarin gas was used in the eastern Ghouta region of Syria. The U.S., accused Damascus of that attack. Was that pretty well corroborated?
As far as I know, I believe it was. It appears that there definitely was a sarin attack at the time, and it appears that the Syrian government was responsible for it, you know, which is why I think it's easy to accuse the Syrian government of using, continuing to use chemical weapons and weapons which they really shouldn't have if all of them were eliminated following the U.S.-Russian brokered agreement.
The Syrian army, backed by Russian warplanes, are trying to prevent a new rebel offensive aimed at southwestern Aleppo, a vital city for both sides. Were you surprised at this rebel offensive and how strong it appears to have been?
A little bit surprised, again, because you know, the information we're getting is seemed to be that the entire city was surrounded, and apparently was, and cut off the supplies, and that it was just a matter of days before the various opposition groups trapped in Aleppo would be, you know, starved out over time or surrender or something, as particularly as the Syrian government offered amnesty to rebels that would give up their weapons and other concessions. I think it's not all that surprising, however, that they're trying to regroup, that there be at least one last spasm of coordinated counteroffensive against the Syrian army, and to try to reopen at least one passageway to get resupplies, particularly from the north and from Turkey. It's not a vice grip that the Syrian army and its allies have around Aleppo. There are many porous holes, and they're a very thin line because of resource and manpower problems with the Syrian army and even with some of their allies. So it wouldn't surprise me if the rebels at least temporarily reopen a corridor for resupplying, which they need desperately.
David Lesh of Trinity College. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported Wednesday that regime forces backed by Russian air power recaptured key hilltops and villages on the southwest side of Aleppo. It reports dozens of dead on both sides of the conflict since Sunday. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. For more than two centuries, China and Japan have been working to keep up with Western innovations in information technology, most prominently the typewriter. That history of evolution would have been lost to time if it were not for a unique collection of a Stanford University associate professor. The Chinese Typewriter Museum is about to travel the world, and International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with its curator, Tom Mullaney.
It's Morse and Remington and Underwood and Apple rolled into one.
There's so much to this.
China is an IT giant. It's one of the largest new media and computing markets in the world. China just didn't become this overnight, so there has to be a story to this. And it's like, well, yes, there is a story to this, but you know, we've now got to do some spade work and go dig it up because we've been systematically ignoring it for so long now.
Tell me a little bit about the Chinese Typewriter Museum.
In contrast to the history of Western information technology, there are really no museums or archives dedicated to this subject. There's no one place that a scholar can go to look through the archives of this history. So just by virtue of necessity, I basically had to build an archive myself over the past 10 years. And so this, you know, in a concrete sense, this meant purchasing Chinese telegraph code books and photographs and patent diagrams and ephemera, and also Chinese typewriters, Japanese typewriters, word processors, and computers, many of which were actually donated to me. And about three, four years ago, I kind of almost like woke up from a dream and realized that outside of, I don't know, the Smithsonian or maybe the National Library of China or the National Diet Library, that I had amassed one of the world's largest collections, if not the largest coherent collection on this subject.
We, of course, in the West are used to an alphabet. In China, that's not the case. In fact, there are 70,000 characters they were choosing from in trying to come up with a typewriter. This must have been a phenomenal engineering feat.
It was. Chinese is the one major world script that does not have an alphabet or a syllabary whatsoever. And so from the 19th century onward, the urgent question that was facing Chinese modernizers and politicians and intellectuals and everyday individuals was, how can China participate and take part in these game-changing communications technologies like telegraphy and typewriting and moving forward? Because every one of those technologies was, by accident of history, invented in the alphabetic world and at no fault of their own by inventors who, quite understandably, were thinking with the alphabet in mind. So every time one of these new technologies began to emerge, the question was the same. How do we fit the one major world language that has no alphabet and more than 70,000 characters onto this new technology? The engineers who had to think about these puzzles didn't have to just think outside the box, to use that cliche. They had to forget the box even existed. They had to reimagine not only what the Chinese language would be like moving into the future, but also what the typewriter would be or what information technology would be, because everything was going to have to change in order for the Chinese language to participate in these information technologies. It couldn't just make this transition in any simplistic, straightforward way. So yeah, they're absolutely brilliant engineers and linguists in this story.
Tom, thank you so much for spending time with me and telling me so much more about this.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And that is the curator of the Chinese Typewriter Museum, Tom Mullaney, and he was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. The Chinese Typewriter exhibit is at Stanford and then on to San Francisco International Airport. After making several stops around the world, Tom Mullaney says his goal is to transfer the entire collection to an institution to make it open and available to researchers and the public. Sounds like a very good idea. Well, elsewhere in Asian-related news, President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama hosted Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong and his wife at the White House Tuesday evening for a state dinner. The Black Tie Affair, the 12th state dinner of the Obama presidency, marked the 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the United States and the Pacific Island nation. The two countries share close economic and security ties, with more than 3,500 American companies maintaining a presence in the Asian city-state. Both countries signed onto the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015, and Singapore was the first country of Southeast Asia to join the fight against Islamic State extremists. The last U.S. state dinner for Singapore occurred in 1985, when then-President Ronald Reagan hosted Lee's late father, Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the United States Department of State issues its annual Trafficking in Persons Report, also known as a TIP report, which evaluates the efforts of 188 countries and territories, including the United States, to fight modern slavery. The purpose of this report is to enlighten, energize, and empower, writes Secretary of State John Kerry in his introduction of the 2016 report. By issuing it, we want to bring to the public's attention the full nature and scope of the $150 billion illicit human trafficking industry. Those countries with governments that fully comply with the standards fall into Tier 1. Countries that do not comply but are making significant efforts to do so are on Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list includes countries that do not comply with the minimum standards, but are making significant efforts, but no more so than during the previous year, and have a significant number of trafficked persons. Finally, countries on Tier 3 do not comply with the minimum standards and are not making significant efforts to do so. Last year, 19 countries moved up in the tier rankings, while 27 were downgraded. This year's report focuses on successes in fighting modern-day slavery and what needs to be done to counter traffickers' tactics. Because even though governments have enacted new laws against all forms of human trafficking, are prosecuting traffickers, are protecting victims and empowering them to rebuild their lives, and have elevated public consciousness about this crime, there is still so much more that needs to be done. Still, if there is a single theme to this year's Trafficking in Persons report, it is the conviction that there is nothing inevitable about trafficking in human beings, writes Secretary of State John Kerry. Just because a certain abuse has taken place in the past doesn't mean that we have to tolerate that abuse in the future, or that we can afford to avert our eyes. Instead, we should be asking ourselves, what if that victim of trafficking was my daughter, son, sister, or brother? Secretary Kerry concludes this year's TIP report asks us questions, because ending modern slavery isn't just a fight we should attempt, it is a fight we can and must win.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.